Welcome to The Plants We Eat, an investigation of the history, biology, and culture of the plants that we use for food. I'm Jeff Gilman, director of the UNC Charlotte Botanical Gardens and plant history enthusiast.
And I'm Cindy Proctor, instructor at CPCC, Charlotte, North Carolina, and an urban landscape consultant.
And today we're going to talk about a kind of a non-plant, kind of.
Yeah, but we eat it.
We do. We do eat it today.
We enjoy it.
Today we are talking about mad honey. And mad honey is actually kind of like what it sounds like. It's honey that will make you nuts.
And sounds interesting.
It's very interesting. And I know we both really enjoyed studying this particular podcast. And let's start by talking about what honey is. And many of you out there probably already know, so we're not going to go too in-depth, but I think it's interesting. What honey basically is, and it's actually produced by a number of different insects, but primarily by the honeybee. Mm-hmm. And what the honeybee does, and by the way, the honeybee is a European bee. When we see it here in the United States, it actually is an introduced species. And what the honeybee does is it goes to flowers and grabs nectar. Some of this, now nectar, just in a nutshell, nectar is sugar. Sugar dissolved in a little bit of water, and nectar is there to attract bees and wasps and other things. They come and drink the nectar, and then while they're there, they grab pollen and transfer it from one plant to another. So it's a way the plant helps to reproduce itself, to get pollen from one place to another. Now, the nectar is useful to the bee, first of all, for energy. Bees flap their wings a lot. That takes a lot of energy, a lot of carbohydrates. So when a bee comes to a flower and grabs nectar, the first thing it's going to use that nectar for is flying. But invariably, it doesn't use up all the nectar that it captures. Some of this nectar gets regurgitated, literally thrown back up when it gets back into the hive, into the honeycomb. When it throws this nectar back up, it then goes through a process of actually drying this down, in other words, getting rid of some of the water, and actually concentrates these sugars that it has grabbed from the flowers. These concentrated sugars and some enzymes and actually a little bit of pollen and some other stuff, this is what we call honey. And, you know, and it's delicious.
It is delicious.
And, you know, actually the bees, I think about maple syrup. And maple syrup was the primary sweetener that we had here in the U.S. before we had honey. And actually, the Native Americans here taught the Europeans how to concentrate sap from trees to make it more sugary. And it's kind of neat with the bees because they actually go to all the effort of—
Yeah, they do all the work.
Right, they do all the work mm-hmm. for us. And I think it's important to point out why they try and get rid of the water, why we get rid of the extra water for the maple syrup and why the bees got rid of the water for the honey. They get rid of it because as the sugar content increases, as the water goes away and the sugar content increases, bacteria and other microbes actually have a much tougher time growing.
Oh, I had no idea.
Right.
That makes sense, though.
Why we drive that water off in maple syrup and in honey. All right, so honey, have you ever heard of monofloral honey?
No.
Okay, well, monofloral honey is actually, it's a honey that is made with primarily one type of flower, okay? You've probably heard of like sourwood honey buckwheat honey.
Mm-hmm.
Right, well, and buckwheat honey, by the way, nasty. I just can't stand it.
I know. When you said that, I was like, oh.
Just doesn't taste very, it's different. I should say it's different.
I've had plenty of sourwood honey. It's really
right.
good.
And that's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, these monofloral honeys, it's not actually made with a single type of flower, but it's primarily one type of flower. So these monofloral honeys, one of the nice things about them is that they're very predictable in terms of how they'll taste. Most of your sourwood honeys taste pretty similar. Most of your buckwheat honeys taste pretty similar. So that's awesome. And for some of these honeys, they're actually said to have certain beneficial properties. One interesting one is Manuka honey. And Manuka honey is a honey that's known to have antimicrobial properties, and it's sometimes used to treat wounds and burns. And you can actually find this on Amazon or wherever. And it's said to be useful, and there is some evidence that it is antimicrobial beyond just the sugar concentration. It actually has certain properties that make it antimicrobial. So here's the thing. Monofloral honey, though, isn't always necessarily yummy, delicious, and good for us. There is one particular honey that I found from bees that are getting their nectar from plants in the Euphorbia family. What's Euphorbia? I think poinsettia. Mm-hmm. Okay, so mm-hmm. Poinsettias, you already know that they're a little bit toxic. Most right. of us know poinsettias are kind of toxic. Well, bees that get their nectar primarily from Euphorbia are actually going to produce a honey that is pretty dangerous, pretty poisonous. So you don't want to mess with that.
You don't want Euphorbia honey.
You don't want Euphorbia honey. And if it has a tiny little bit, it's no big deal. But if we're getting most of our nectar from Euphorbia, it's going to be literally a dangerous honey. Mad honey is a little bit like that, except that it's supposed to give you, it's supposed to have many properties. It's supposed to give you a high. It's supposed to treat all kinds of ailments, everything from diabetes to sexual dysfunction. It's supposed to just have these wonderful properties. So then the question is, where does this mad honey come from? And this mad honey comes from bees that have been feasting upon rhododendron and mountain laurel.
Such a historical plant.
It is.
At least here in the South.
Well, there's all kinds of tales from long ago of honey. The first one that you really hear about is in Turkey. And Turkey is where most mad honey is produced. Not all, but most mad honey is produced in Turkey. And in about 400 BC, this guy named Xenophon with his army of 10,000 camped out in a small town and became intoxicated. And they had no idea why, Xenophon had no idea why all of his men seemed, you know, to be totally intoxicated, and ends up that he figured out that it was from the honey. And the honey, even at that point in time, had a history of, you know, making people intoxicated, usually not killing them, but causing issues, usually including vomiting, hallucinations, you know, just all kinds of interesting things. I think, though, the most interesting instance of mad honey poisoning was in 67 BC. In 67 BC, General Pompey and Roman troops that he was leading invaded the Black Sea region, and their path was actually lined with chunks of honeycomb, which the Roman soldiers ate. And you see, the thing about mad honey is that it doesn't affect you immediately. It has a latency period, a period where you don't look like you've been poisoned. And this latency period can be up to 2 hours. If you want to poison somebody with mad honey, that's actually a good thing to use because, you know, if he has tasters tasting the honey, the tasters won't immediately be poisoned. The poisoning won't become obvious for at least a few minutes and potentially as much as 2 hours. So the army ate this honey that was sitting beside the side of the road, and they easily came, and they when they became intoxicated, they became easy prey for King, and I'm going to butcher his name, and I'm sorry about this for all you Romans out there, King Mithridates of Pontus, who's by the way, also known as the Poison King. He was obsessed with poison of many types, and he actually took small doses of a lot of different types of poison so that he could build up a resistance to these poisons over time. So anyway, the Poison King actually stopped the Roman troops by getting them intoxicated and then, you know, running them through with spears, which I just think is an awesome story. But, you know, the crazy thing is it doesn't end at all with the Romans. We also see this in the American Civil War, and it was never used as an offensive weapon or even as a defensive weapon.
Too bad, though.
But yeah, it is too bad. But there are actually a lot of notes on people who saw it during the Civil War. But The first instance of it occurring in the United States was recorded by Benjamin Smith Barton, and actually in 1794. And he wrote, "In the year 1785, I had the opportunity of observing some of the disagreeable effects of our wild honey on several persons who had eaten it in the western part of Pennsylvania." So that's what he wrote. And then he goes on to discuss the color of the honey, which for mad honey is usually a crimson or reddish, which, by the way, is true of all of the rhododendrons, Kalmias. Again, we said this is in a group called the Ericaceae, and most of your, which is the heath and heather family, and most of your honeys, your monofloral honeys from the heath and heather family are crimson or reddish.
You know, I had no idea. That's an interesting fact.
It is, yeah. It's also supposed to have a bitter flavor. And then,
did you say better or bitter?
Bitter.
Okay.
Bitter. And then Mr. Barton goes on to describe the benefits of vomiting the honey up. It's a good thing to vomit it up. And he related how the effects of eating the honey would have effects similar to laudanum for helping people sleep. So, and I don't know if you know what laudanum is, but it's a combination of opium and alcohol.
Oh.
And actually it is still available in, you know, certain ways, but laudanum is kind of the old name for this combination of alcohol and opium.
Well, those two would definitely help you sleep.
Yeah. for sure. So mad honey was apparently supposed to help you sleep. And then in 1875, a Dr. Grammer, who had served as a physician for the Confederates during the Civil War, he said, "Wherever the mountain laurel grows, the bees are very fond of it. It is dangerous for anyone unable to detect the taste to eat the honey. It has a highly poisonous effect, being an extremely distressing narcotic, varying in its effects in proportion to the quantity eaten." So he's basically saying that the more of this poisonous honey you eat, the worse it is. But he's also pointing out that you can detect it if you know what you're looking for. He describes seeing it frequently during the war, and he also describes trying it himself. And when he described it himself, he says, "Sometime after eating, a queer sensation of tingling all over, indistinct vision caused by dilation of the pupils, with an empty, dizzy feeling about the head and a horrible nausea that would not relieve itself by vomiting." And it's interesting because some people say you can relieve the poisoning by vomiting, and some people say you can't. You know, I want to reiterate, I said that it's not usually toxic. There are a number of instances I found where people were killed by this. It's just not the most frequent occurrence, but it certainly does happen. The toxin that's in the rhododendrons is actually known as a Greana toxin. And if we look at greanotoxin poisoning itself, in low amounts, greanotoxins cause hallucinations and lightheadedness. They are a type of nerve toxin. With greater quantities, you get vomiting, dizziness, weakness, and a tingling around your extremities and mouth. With heavier doses, you get low blood pressure and extremely slow heartbeat. Death can occur, but usually the person, usually the poison is processed pretty quickly by the body. Damage is almost never permanent. It's not to say some people do have permanent injury, but almost, that's very, very rare. And the poisoning is usually lasts anywhere from a few hours to a day. Now, you know, an interesting thing, you can buy mad honey online, if you look around just a little bit. It doesn't come right up on Amazon, but you can find it. It goes for somewhere around $100 a pound, sometimes a little cheaper, sometimes a little bit more expensive. And I actually watched a couple of people who apparently a little bit nuts try this on YouTube, and they had... The primary effect it seemed to have on them was a little bit of lightheadedness and sleepiness. That's really all they seemed to experience.
I'm sure it's difficult to find the concentrations of the Greana toxins, or what we just don't know, though, do we?
No, we
don't know the concentrations needed.
Well, and that's another part of the problem is that the bees are feeding on different rhododendrons,
sure,
which are going to have different levels of granulocytes. And that was another thing that became evident pretty quickly in the research that I was doing, which is that levels of granulocytes are obviously going to vary quite a bit from one batch of mad honey to the next batch of mad honey. And where in one case, a tablespoon might be enough to make a person violently ill, in the next case, a tablespoon might not even be enough to give a feeling of lightheadedness. I left my research on this thinking that this is not something that I would ever want to experiment with because of the highly variable effects that it can have.
I was just going to ask if you were going to buy some.
This is not one that right. I would.
But at the same time, it's not. I don't think it's a problem.
No. This, I mean, they talk about the opioid crisis in the United States. I don't think we're going to have a mad honey crisis. An interesting thing, most of the poisonings that you read about are actually poisonings from Turkey, mm-hmm. where this is actually sold as a real product and people take it. And most of the poisonings actually occur in middle-aged men, and they occur in middle-aged men apparently mostly because they're trying to use the honey to solve. Well, they're trying to use the honey to substitute for Viagra.
I see.
To be perfectly honest, and this kind of poisoning led to a number of different articles, some with very interesting names. And I got to read this one scientific article, which I had thought had just about the best title for a scientific article that I've ever read. And this is the title again. I just love this: Mad Honey Sex. Therapeutic misadventures from an ancient biological weapon. You've got to love that.
That's right.
just hilarious.
There's a lot of correctness in there too.
In one case, there was one article I read within the last year. A woman from Germany of Turkish descent was poisoned with the honey, collapsed, and had to be taken to the hospital. But her husband wants her to continue using this honey because of its therapeutic values. It's just crazy. It's also worth pointing out that different animals have different susceptibilities to the granulocytes, and pigs, sheep, rabbits, and mice really don't seem to be very susceptible to this poison, but guinea pigs actually are. And when they study granulocytes for their possible effects on humans, guinea pigs are actually the model that they'll use. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Sure. Well, you know, for kalmia, you shouldn't plant kalmia near a sheep because they'll eat it and it's very poisonous.
And it's probably because of the granulocytes. So where would you plant these various rhododendrons and these mountain laurels?
Well, the thing is, I think we should point out, that it surprises me that there's only a few species that have this toxin, mm-hmm. you know, when rhododendron has hundreds, you know, of species.
Yeah, there's a lot of different types of rhododendrons.
And not the rhododendrons you're ever going to buy here in the United States are going to be an issue. Now, I did do research where the Katabiense rhododendron, the one that we plant the most here in the South, it has lineage from some of the rhododendron species that do have the granulocytes. So, but I don't think it's enough for us to worry about.
Now, is that actually from some of the Turkish rhododendrons? Or is that from some of our United States rhododendrons?
Well, that from both of them, actually. Okay. So the granulocytes is found in the rhododendron maximum, which is the Latin name of a certain rhododendron that's found here in the United States.
Okay.
The other two that have been documented are the rhododendron ponticum and the luteum.
Okay.
And they're usually found in Europe.
Okay.
And they're very popular in Europe as their own plant, but also their rootstocks are used a good bit.
Why are their rootstocks used? Just a strong rootstock?
Yeah, it's invasive. Those two species.
So it must be a strong rootstock.
Yeah, the ponticum and the luteum can be invasive in some of the European countries. So yeah, they're using their rootstocks to help with create cultivars for other rhododendrons and azaleas, which I don't know if they would transfer the granulocytes to those. You know, we've talked about that. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know.
Who knows? Now, the Katabiense hybrid has that American lineage, mm-hmm. but it also has the ponticum in its lineage too.
So who knows much Grayonotoxin is in that.
Right. But I don't, I mean, you know, we're all eating local honey because that supposedly helps with your allergies, right? And yeah. And it tastes better and people like to buy local. But I don't think it's an issue. Now, Kalmia is another plant.
The mountain laurel.
The mountain laurel, which is also from the Ericaceae family.
It's all over the mountains.
Yes, it's
here.
All over. Well, rhododendrons are all over the mountains.
Yeah, here in North Carolina, mm-hmm. we're full of rhododendrons. We're full of mountain laurel. And yeah, I was just mentioning to you earlier today before we started doing the show that in the botanical gardens that I run, we've got actually 1,000 different types of rhododendrons out there, and we have a honeybee hive in a hollow tree.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if we pulled that comb out, I'm wondering how much Grayonotoxin might
be. I think you should get it tested. Yeah. Where would you go, though?
I guess I shouldn't test that on any unsuspecting colleagues anyway. I'll have to not do that.
Oh, gosh, I'm not, I'm worried now. But, you know, a little bit of interesting fact about Kalmia. I read that, you know, its stamens where it has the pollen on it, mm-hmm. that their filaments are bent. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as an insect lands on it, it projects, you know, its pollen mm-hmm. onto the insect. So it's making sure that it's getting on the insect.
Have you never watched that?
No.
Oh, Cindy, this spring I'm going to take you to the gardens and we'll watch that on some of our Kalmia.
Do you need to have, it seems so small. Like it would be on, you have to
know. No, it's easy to see.
Easy to watch.
Okay. Easy to watch.
Well, you know, when it does extend their filaments, it says it can throw its pollen up to 3 feet.
I'd say that's about right.
Is that about right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was fascinating to me when I was reading that.
It's very cool. It's like a hairpin trigger and it just pop, pop, pop.
So yeah. What's the take home message? Well, first of all, I have something to ask you.
Yeah.
How long, did you find out that how long do the effects of mad honey last? Did you say
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah.
You did?
But it lasts any place from a couple of hours up to a day.
Okay.
And I found one instance where it seems to perhaps have lasted 2 days, but generally speaking, okay. a few hours to a day. And most of those effects are just tiredness and nausea.
So it's not all poisonous plants will create mad honey.
No.
It's just the Grayonotoxin.
It's just the Grayonotoxin.
Yep, that is in there. Okay. Well, so the take-home message is... That
don't try it,
but that you're not, just because you have rhododendron and kalmia in your garden doesn't mean that you're going to and then you're going to eat local honey.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't mean you're going to have a problem.
No, it does not mean you're
okay.
going to. And you know, again, if your bees go to a couple of rhododendrons while they're visiting so many other things,
it's so dilute.
Okay. It's not going to be a big deal.
No, not at all. Okay. Well, this has been interesting.
It has been. I did want to ask you a couple of things. In terms of, because you've done a little bit more planting of these plants than I have. I haven't dealt with rhododendron and kalmia that much. In terms of planting, are these tough plants to grow?
Yes.
You know, that's...
Well, it's because they are native, you know, to the Southeast, especially mm-hmm. The Smoky Mountain area, Appalachian area. But, you know, we try to grow things in urban areas. It's just a whole nother ballgame. And usually it's because our soil's really heavy because of compaction, and that is hard for them to thrive. And then we put them in full sun. So what I recommend is everybody wants these two because they are very beautiful.
Kalmia, again, the mountain laurel is one
yeah.
of the most beautiful flowers that you'd ever want to see. And once you learn how to trigger that little thing on the flower, mm-hmm. you show it to a kid, they'll be doing it all day. It is really cool.
Well, and kalmia is a little bit harder to grow than the rhododendron, to be honest, mm-hmm. and especially in urban areas. But if you loosen the soil and give it a part sun environment, you know, I think you would have great success and create a soil, whether or not we get too much rain or not enough, it's going to be okay. And that's usually, you can't control weather, but you can control the soil, I think, with plenty of amendments.
And I will say that if you're going to plant mountain laurel, buy small, young kalmia.
Yes.
I know it's great to buy the big ones and you feel like you're getting a deal on this big plant. When a plant is tough to transplant, plant it when it's younger. Buy the smallest one that you reasonably can.
And they are expensive because they are slow growing.
Tough to propagate.
And they're tough to propagate. And so all of that expense has been passed on to the consumer, of course. And rhododendron, you know, another thing that's tough about them, they can get Phytophthora root rot.
Yes.
And that is...
They have a number of diseases.
Yeah, they do. But boy, they are worth growing. They are just really beautiful.
But they're another one. Another thing about rhododendron, though, here in Charlotte, North Carolina, at the botanical gardens, they grow well. Up in the mountains, they grow well. But in most of Charlotte and the sunny regions, just too much heat for them. They really do need some shade, some cooler temps.
Yeah, it's just that urban environment that's tough sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's where I come in and try to help folks create that habitat. So,
thank you for listening, and we look forward to talking with you next week.